welcome to CrimeWire, the place for information, news, and most importantly, justice. Our interactive website is www.crimewiresite.com. You can call in any time during the show. The number is 1-646-478-0982. And remember, you can participate in tonight's show simply by going to the live interactive chat room here on Blog Talk Radio. If you are a friend or family member who would like to send CrimeWire information on an unsolved or suspicious death case, or have a specific crime-related topic you'd like to have discussed on a future show, please email us at thecrimewire@gmail.com. Tonight's topic is the Haley Dunn case. I'm Kim Colton, Director of Research for CrimeWire, and I'll be manning the switchboard and monitoring the chat room. And now, let me introduce the host of tonight's show, statement analyst and CrimeWire consultant, Peter Hyatt. Hi, Peter. How are you tonight?
Hi, Kim. Hi, Karen. I'm doing
Hello.
Well, thank you.
And Karen Goff is with us also.
Yep. Hello, everyone.
Hi, Karen.
Hello.
We've had quite a busy week in terms of the cases that we've been covering, and particularly the disappearance of Haley Dunn is something that we've been covering since January of 2011. And I'll begin a little bit with, I guess, the initial announcement regarding Curtis Lloyd. Curtis was going to come on to the program, and he is not able to speak about what he found, nor is he permitted to speak about why he can't speak about what he found that day. So that I am permitted to say, and those of you with a legal mind understand the language that I'm choosing to use here, but that's the bottom line, is that he would like to have been on the program, but he is not permitted to, and he is not permitted to even go into an explanation beyond what I've just given. So we hope to have him on after he's released from that restriction, and that should be, I think, something of great interest to listeners. I have been asked and at times even challenged that Mr. Lloyd was not truthful and Mr. Lloyd was this or that, and I was being duped again, that sort of thing. When he spoke to media, he presented as an intelligent and caring man, and when I interviewed him over the phone, it was confirmed. His sentences were straightforward, truthful, strong use of the pronoun I, no need to qualify that which normally shouldn't be qualified, and so I deemed him as truthful, and as we learned officially on Friday, the remains were confirmed that they were Haley Dunn. I had said that the remains would be found in Scurry County because Sean Atkins was indicated for veracity, truthfulness, when he said that that she could be found in Scurry County, or they should look in Scurry County. But Karen, it was actually you who went out a little bit on a limb and said that based upon the words of the mother, person of interest, Billie Jean Dunn, based upon her words, you said it was a very strong likelihood that this was Haley, where I had refrained to go that far in conclusion, and so I commend you for that. But you seemed convinced from the beginning, as soon as the mother spoke, that this was indeed Haley, and you were correct. Any thoughts on that?
I wish I could remember what I said. Yeah, we have been looking at so many statements in this case that I'm trying to recall what it was that she said. Was it on the radio?
No, it was actually some of it, unfortunately, was emailed between you and me.
Oh, okay.
It was regarding the very different demeanor. You had said that her words showed a much more seriousness than they did in March of 2012.
Oh, yes.
The gravity had caught your attention.
Okay, and that was what I did, was compared her words from the 2012, March 2012 finding. Let me just bring that. You don't happen to have those handy, do you, by any chance?
I don't.
Yeah,
I don't,
okay.
I wish, if I would have brought them up for our guests and our listeners to in the chat room to take a look at. But yeah, that would be great. Okay,
yeah, I can actually find as we go along. As we're going along, I can pull them up.
That's what I'm doing. I'm just going back into my emails to see. We have exchanged, Peter and I have exchanged so many emails.
3:46 in the morning.
Yes. I was going
to
ask you
too.
About that. That when I got up this morning, and I mean, I'm an early riser myself, sort of. And but when I saw the time on the email that you sent me, I thought, whoa, 3:45, I think it said. That told me that if you're sending me, if the, you know, the analysis, you've just been doing the analysis, that you must have been up all night. Were you?
I wasn't up all night. What had happened was, and I think listeners can appreciate this, for me, this has been a lot of analysis. The mother has been just incessant in talking to media. In fact, her attorney seems like he's in competition with her for attention. He recently was quoted, and Mr. Lloyd would have addressed this himself, but he was recently quoted in media as saying, "I spoke to the man that found the remains in March." And Curtis said, "I did not speak to John Young." So that is a lie. It is not truthful. And Billy Dunn's followers, which is a small group, and it's actually getting smaller as it goes on. It was once upon a time in probably January, February of 2011. It was a rather larger group, and they were very angry. This is when I received some death threats against me and my family early on. I had written an article, an open letter to Billy Dunn, asking her to come clean for the sake of her daughter, that her daughter was dead. And the emotional, illogical response was that I was hurting Haley and was hurting Haley's feelings, and just really silly responses. And some were quite angry, though. The support dwindled over time. At the six-month anniversary, Billy Dunn said, "You know, I'll see you all in 6 months," that kind of thing, telegraphing that she knew that the child was not going to be found. And there was this incessant drive to speak before the media, where she was continually deceptive in her speech, and it was easy to pick up and useful for teaching and that sort of thing. But there's always been a provocative factor in all of this, and it's like the liar standing before the audience and just flipping the bird off at his audience, saying, "You can't catch me." And every time she's caught, she'll become even more emboldened. Well, for me, it was and has been a quest for justice for Haley from the beginning. From the first 5 minutes on the Nancy Grace show, we knew Haley was dead, as the mother was referencing her in the past tense. But it's always been analysis and putting the puzzle together, looking for those, as Conan calls, the slip marbles that come out of all of our mouths. And in the middle of the night last night, the horror of what Haley experienced, what Haley likely experienced, what I believe Haley experienced, and what evidence may show, and I'm restricted in what I'm saying, hit me in full force. I was overcome with a feeling of dread and fright. Mm. And I've come to believe that Sean Atkins was sexually molesting this child, sexually abusing this child, and that Billy Dunn did not come to her rescue, but came in her anger, as Dr. Lillian Glass had pointed out. So that these two were locked together, and again, this is speculation, no one has yet been charged and no one's been convicted, and all parties are innocent until proven guilty in a court of law, but we all have opinions on the case. And my opinion mirrors somewhat the opinion of Haley's own grandmother, who said this on national television. And this angered, it did not anger Billy Dunn when the grandmother said it on national television, but it angered her and her attorney when someone blogging from the woods in Maine someplace put up an article about it. And so I do know it touched a nerve. And so I do believe that Haley was a victim of sexual abuse and that Haley was a victim of some pretty severe violence that took place that night. And that before that she had been groomed sexual abuse. He may have even been drugged that night. I don't know. We will likely find out more things than people might realize. But that horror was just driven home to me, and I got up, I think, probably around 2:30 or so, and someone had sent me a message that, once again, Billy Dunn was posting on Facebook, almost in a matter that appears to be in competition with her own attorney for attention. And as she was posting away, I began the analysis in a very foggy brain, and I shot it off to you, Karen, knowing that you would take probably a better rested, more sober-minded view of it than I had, coming from the emotional position of really wanting to understand what Haley went through,
mm-hmm.
wanting to understand that she was a victim who not only didn't have a mother to protect her, but a mother whose own words reveal this is her story, this is her intent to lie. And I have an article going up, and I'll post it after the program, on intent. And what intent simply means is the presuppositional thinking that says when someone speaks, there is an intention to be understood. And that's why it's subject to analysis. People do not speak with the expectation that no one will understand them. And so their intent comes out in their words. And her intent has been, since that first appearance, I think it was January 3rd, the first week of January of 2011, her intent was, just as she said, that she needed an alibi. As she said, what happened? Haley Dunn went missing while I was at work. My daughter went missing while I was at work, establishing the fact that she was at work as a priority for her.
Mm.
So this came crashing down in a really difficult, and one of those things where I just could not sleep and just filled with that type of dread of what this poor child experienced. And there still is a small semblance of people that support the mother, and even in the last couple of days, I think that number has dropped. It will continue to drop. I think she'll have less supporters when she's arrested. She'll have less supporters when she's convicted. But even then, as she goes to prison or to the death penalty or whatever is going to happen, there'll still be people that will write to her and praising her and holding her up to be something special. In January 2011, there seemed to be a number of them who had talked about losing custody of their own children to the state because of relationships with bad men, dangerous men. And so they were able to see in her some form of redemption for themselves, I guess. And it was really strange. So even now, as they continue to slander, I mean, it's the death threats weren't funny, and the threats of violence weren't comical, that sort of thing, to my family, and especially in my wife and children. But it's not unexpected. When Billie Jean Dunn is angry, she reaches into what she knows. She uses the language of sexual violence. Often she calls for violence, and she uses, you know, gender or someone's private parts in her description. This is the life that Haley Dunn lived, this type of
that
abuse.
Is. And Peter, I have to just interject here. That is so sad. I can't imagine how long this was going on in Haley's life, and everything you're saying is it's sad, right, Karen? I mean,
I'd like to continue, though, because it's really important that this message get out.
I'm sorry.
So when her supporters, and they called my employment, they sought ways to silence me by making up lies or trying to find dirt on me. When she first got the private investigator, she gave him my name and find somebody on this guy to make him stop. There was a reason. There was an intent behind that. There was a reason why she needed a no-name blogger from the Northeast someplace to stop speaking. There was a reason to silence that. And what she was attempting to silence in my voice was a voice crying out for justice for Haley. So I urge the listeners to not get involved in writing these things on the blog, the comments. When the vile comments go up, we find them, they'll go down. There are many more comments than people realize. And they just see maybe one article and 100 comments, but that's multiplied by, there's, I think, 1,300 posts in total, 1,400 posts in total, and each of them get many comments per day. So it's sometimes hard to keep track of them. But there's no reason to respond to them. They will be put into the spam folder, eventually they're blocked from being able to put those things on. It's a small but radical and vicious group. What they did with Curtis was a disgrace. And he himself had said, you know, they pushed my buttons a few times, and I said perhaps a little more than I should have, which is human nature. So if you would like to comment on the blog, it is a private blog. It is a privilege. It's not a right that someone has. It's not a public blog. And there are foolish comments. They're going to be deleted. If you copy and paste them to answer them, yours will be deleted as well. And I know that's very offensive to some people, but that is just the way it's going to be. In terms of Curtis, I think he's going to be Roy Kronk. And I think some of you know that as a verb. Roy Kronk was the man who found the remains of Kaylee Anthony. And immediately it turned into speculation that he was somehow involved, and Leonard Padilla talked about the daisy chain, and he was tipped off and conspiracy this, conspiracy that, and it's nonsense. And we saw Jose Baez do this, get involved in this nonsense. I will not put it past John Young to do the same thing. But we're not going to feed that in terms of the public persona. And so with a small group of people that some have up to 12 Facebook names, so it looks like they're kind of in unity, when really it's not that at all, and there's this blaring mental illness. I understand these cases attract those types of people. I also understand from eyewitness testimony that Billie Jean Dunn has a good laugh on their expense, and as she holds them in contempt for being even stupider than anyone else to believe her lies. But it won't be part of the blog, and if I have to disable comments entirely, I will do that. Also, that goes for, as I am able to share information, and I say the information is unconfirmed, anonymous sources, that means anonymous or confidential source means it's not going to be posted. And so people say, well, what's your source, as if it's questioning whether the material is valid or not. The material may be correct, may be incorrect, but an anonymous source doesn't want to use the name for whatever reason, and that will be protected. So if there's any comments of someone that's questioning Mr. Lloyd's integrity, they go down. If someone copy and paste it, they go down. People have had enough of the Billie Jean Dunn show. Enough of the nonsense. Justice is starting to arrive now, and she's showing up, and she's angry. Haley has been located. They've known where she's been since the early days. And we have speculated on what happened to Haley, but as even the town manager said well over a year and a half ago, 2 + 2 = 4. We had a home of drug abuse. We had a home of the most vile perversity imaginable. I don't know if people understand what bestiality is. Bestiality is technically the sexual abuse of animals. It means inflicting pain, suffering, on an animal in a way that arouses a sexual reaction from its viewer. These are the people that stomp on and kill puppies and kittens, literally, and cut up deer and all sorts of things, and mix it in a sexual manner to make sexually arousing. This is the stuff they were into. This is what Billie Dunn called her hobby. She's a sociopath. She doesn't think the way other people think. 109,000 deviant images. I have a large family. We all have cameras and phones and everyone. We all have the hobby of videotaping and taking pictures. I think at last count, I was up to about 6,000 pictures, which seems to be a lot to me. 109,000 deviant images collected by the two of them in a period of about 28 months' time. This was a vile obsession. One law enforcement official told me that this guy had on his person at any given time all sorts of memory devices where he could have lots and lots of pictures, which is, I think, what provoked you to say, Karen, I'll ask you about this in a few minutes, about him trophy collecting, that these are people that needed to remember the vile things that they did. There was a need there to remember. This is not Middle America. This is not Casey Anthony, even, where ABC was willing to pay $250,000 for pictures of her doing a bump and grind dance. This is child pornography. That means for child pornography, it means a child has, it's an evidence of a crime of a child where they prove under the age of 12. It's not digitally altered. It's not CAD, computer-aided design. It's not borderline, barely legal. It is where a child, in its innocency, is harmed for the sexual gratification of its viewers. So I think that people don't always understand how devious this is. I was involved in a number of child pornography cases. Not a single time did I ever ask to see any of the evidence in the cases. Even when offered, I turned it down. There would be someone that would be attesting to the fact that the imagery was real and that the actors in it, that's what they call them, were under the age of 12. I don't need to see that. I didn't need to see it, and I declined to see it each and every time because I did not want that type of material even engaging in my mind. It's beyond horror. This was the life of Haley Dunn. This is what she was like. And these followers and these Billy Dunn groupies need to realize who the heroine that they're following is. And those who have clipped their names aboard to them thinking that this is some kind of a fun game, a trial by Facebook, that's all going to come to a crashing end when evidence is presented and you're going to hear of a very little girl who had suffered her entire life, What most parents think of as normal is not normal to them. And what Billy Dunn considers normal, in fact, what she describes as being wonderful, we describe as abuse, neglect, exploitation. It's an entirely different world, and I don't think that people grasp the horror of the situation. And if those remains speak, and they might, if those remains speak, we may learn just how badly this little girl suffered. And we'll see what happens with the following afterwards.
Oh, so Peter.
There's bickering for money. There's all sorts of posturing going on. Right now, what they need to do is wait until the father is on the scene, and when the remains can be released, they can be released to him. And the community, who has cared far more than any of those people involved, can begin to heal after they bury her and get justice for her. Go ahead, Kim.
Oh, I was just, yeah, I'm just saying yes to everything you're saying. I mean, I'm so glad that you set everybody straight about the blog. And it is. I think that when people realize, when it comes down to it, what kind of, like I said before, what kind of life she led, it just.
Yeah, well, and I'd like to say that Peter's, I think, Peter, without knowing that he was answering a question, one of the guests here had asked if we could speak to the impact statement analysis has on us, or if it does have an effect on us. And I think you answered the question quite eloquently. In fact, you illustrated it quite eloquently, not only through your words, but also through the emotion in your voice that's quite apparent. And it's true, statement analysis, when we get in really deep into a case, and as Peter has done, he has been involved virtually from the start. So he has read everything, and as an analyst, he reads every single word, and it's almost as if he absorbs every single word. I know that's the way I do it. I absorb the words as I'm reading them, and I think by this point, Peter, you were so overloaded with information that your brain now is putting it all together as a complete movie with sound effects and all of that completely put together.
I think that's a fair description.
I've had the same thing happen, most particularly with child abuse cases. I have analyzed a few transcripts from child abuse cases. But there was also one case that I analyzed, and it was a long case, and it was disturbing. Two people ended up dead in this occurrence. And I had analyzed the transcripts. I took a long time. It took me, I think it was a couple of weeks, because I work slowly. But I had to take many breaks during the analysis because I got so overloaded with the words and the picture that the words were painting for me. It was very difficult. And, yes, there are times when I just have to get up and walk away and do something else, go outside. In fact, one of my favorite things to do in the spring, summer, and fall is weeding. When I'm particularly puzzled by something or if I'm particularly upset by something, I will go out and I'll start picking weeds out of the garden. It's my way of dealing with it.
Exactly. And that is part of, like you said, one of the questions from Miss Lemon. What is the most difficult aspect of statement analysis for each of you personally? And I guess you kind of answered that by saying how you handle it, because it must be extremely difficult. And another thing that Ms. Lemon had asked was, what is the most rewarding aspect of statement analysis for each of you? So we've got the difficult part of it and then the most rewarding. Karen?
The most rewarding aspect?
Yeah.
When I put someone behind bars.
I love it.
When I help to put someone behind bars.
Exactly.
I realize that may sound a little flippant, but that speaks to justice. And I think that's ultimately what we are looking to do, is to bring the truth out and let justice then take it from there.
Exactly. And Peter, what is your most rewarding aspect of statement analysis for you?
Well, I think when a portrait comes into full view, because Karen has said putting someone behind bars, and it's the ultimate reward. It's not where we could go and say, Your Honor, she used the pronoun we, therefore we find the defendant guilty. It's not like that. It's very tiny little steps that point investigators in a certain direction, yet they still have to go out and complete that work. And so as they complete that work, and if we have had any part in putting the direction bear left here or bear right here, I think that's just a great reward to have.
Mm-hmm.
And for the emotional aspects, at this point more than a few locals have said that they bawled their eyes out when the announcement was official. Some of the searchers said the same thing to me. They just cried. And mm-hmm. Some felt a sense of depression, because even though they had, and a couple said, I disagreed with your analysis because I didn't want to believe that Haley was dead. And so therefore I had to discount everything that you said. So I had to, some have asked for forgiveness of some of the things that they said about me, which I don't really want to know, but they have come to realize that this little girl is dead and she'll never go to the prom. She'll never know what it's like to walk down the aisle getting married. She'll never know the joy of having her own grandchild. She'll never have any of those things. And to make things feel like salt on a wound, her life was a life of fear and degradation. So to know that if even just 1% or 0.1% of the work that's gone on behind the scenes will help convict those responsible for her death, I don't know there would be any greater reward than that.
Exactly. That would. Let me. As long as we're on some questions, let me. If you don't mind, Peter and Karen, I can ask a couple more. This one is from Hobbs. It's amazing how desperate Billy is coming across, as in her Facebook post. There is a rapid backpedaling and distancing, as if she only just found out Sean is a pervert. and we were talking about, you know, her recent Facebook post earlier. What do you say to that?
Well, I'm going to say that it's not only a consciousness of guilt, but Karen, if you don't mind, if you have that material in front of you,
mm-hmm.
This would be a great one to pitch into you, because I think you did excellent work on this. And that what I ask now is that listeners listen very carefully, because Karen will move through it slowly. And within those words, I think that you'll see that consciousness of guilt that may end up being heard and echoed in the ears of the jury. So, Karen, we start with the mother posting on Facebook, and we recognize, of course, that we did not see her type these words into a computer. We're just making a leap that this is actually her and her name and her title and that sort of thing, and we are analyzing the statement, not the person.
Right.
But going on that, if you could read the statement that was posted, and then we can go into it, I think that would be of great value to listeners.
Okay. All right, this is what was posted. I beg all pedophiles, child murderers, and their families, you must have had an inkling that demon was in there. Kill yourselves, save our babies. And shame on your families, who know you best for not getting you placed somewhere where you can't murder babies. Shame on them for ignoring that you have a monster deep down. Is your family proud? My daughter is dead. You should have taken your own life. Your family should have acted on signs. They are just as guilty. So, and one of the things that I first read, and this is one of the things with statement analysis, is we start, generally we don't read through the whole thing first. When we sit down to do an analysis on a statement, we start with the first sentence, and analyze the first sentence, and we analyze it according to how, in the same way that the person wrote it. Because, of course, when a person writes the first sentence, they don't know what the fifth, sixth, or seventh sentence is going to be. They only know what the first sentence is going to be. And the first sentence, when they've completed that, allows them then to write the second sentence. So when I looked at this, I read the first few words, and my first question was, she lists pedophiles first. Now, as far as I know, now maybe she's been told by law enforcement that the remains showed, or evidence shows, that Haley had been sexually abused before she died. But I tend to think that's not likely. So my question is, why did she bring in pedophiles when her daughter has been murdered, obviously. That, I mean, we can all safely say that I think that murder is what happened here. But murder and sexual assault don't necessarily go hand in hand. So why did she say pedophiles first? And because she said them first, pedophiles are even more important to her than child murderers. That's a big question. Why does she have a pedophile on her mind right now?
What is she introducing with that word first?
A pedophile is, well, first of all, it's about sex. It's about an adult who has inappropriate and sexual fantasies, sexual interest in a prepubescent child. And it deals with sex.
So this is the mother, and take it from the point of being innocent, alleged, you know, not judicially innocent, but de facto innocent. She would like people to believe that she has no knowledge of anything. All that has been told to her is that the remains were her daughter. There
right.
was nothing more given to her than that.
Right.
And immediately she jumped and introduced the topic of sexual perversion with a child.
Exactly. Exactly. And as
Very
we all know, the brain knows what it knows.
Yeah.
Do we think that's the marble that has maybe rolled,
yeah.
rolled out?
The marble rolled out, I'm afraid. Peter?
I can't help but wonder what even the remaining supporters think when they saw that. Like, it that's been in denial all the time. One of the denials that she had is she said on Facebook, who hasn't received bestiality pictures?
Oh, I haven't.
I haven't. Okay, strike one, strike two, strike three. What I did was I posted that around for people just asking, and I asked informally locally here, and I hadn't met anyone. How many of you have had child pornography downloaded to your computer as a pop-up against your will? I've been online since, I think, 1994, and not once have I ever had child pornography thrust upon me, nor downloaded, nor saw it in my computer, and I asked everyone around me the same thing. None of them had it either. Pete Townsend had lots of it.
Yeah.
He had it all the time happening to him, and then that story changed, and this is what pedophiles do. Most people don't understand that pedophilia is something that is found in females as well as males. So the first thing that this statement cries out for, and Karen, you always say, where a person chooses where to begin their statement is often even an indication of why they're writing, is she went even before murder, she mentioned pedophilia. This is to show knowledge. This is why I said it has a consciousness of guilt about it, that this was indeed a sexual homicide. Scary stuff.
It is.
I wonder how many listeners they would see themselves, I'd rather not know statement analysis. I liked it before. I liked it when I was blissfully stupid, and I could think of this as a case where Haley accidentally took one of their oxycodones by accident, and she OD'd, and she died peacefully, and it's tragic, and they covered it up. They rushed to that. They rushed to that in the baby Ayla case. And that wasn't what happened, and that's not what the blood evidence says in baby Ayla case in Maine. That's us. We're projecting what our lives are like into a statement. And, Karen, I think what you're doing is going towards intent. And this is going to be my premise for the article tonight, is that when someone speaks, there's a presupposition that they're going to be understood. Their marbles are coming out. When you see a blue marble and you don't want to see a blue marble, so you decide to replace that marble, it's going to be one of your own. And that's why we don't interpret. We listen. We're not interpreting anything. We didn't introduce the topic of pedophilia into the case of Haley Dunn. Where did that come from? It came from the mother herself, who has been in roaring denial of all these things. This wasn't someone else's language, and that's why it's so difficult for me to understand how someone could even hear that. There's always that knee-jerk reaction, let me take out what she put in, we saw this in Amanda Knox's case, and then put in my own projected thinking, my own projected beliefs. There always has to be a substitute. Once you go to interpret someone, you've got to put in your own thinking. It's going to be a replacement. I didn't bring up pedophilia. It wasn't in a news broadcast. And Sean Atkins didn't say a word about the remains being found. He kept quiet. She introduced it. It was on her mind. So I think that was a great point, Karen. And if you don't mind, keep going. That would be terrific.
Well, that was actually when I read the first sentence and I looked at that, I thought, that says a lot to me. But moving further on into the what she said, you must have had an inkling that demon was in there. Now, she's speaking to plural, supposedly, all pedophiles, child murderers, and their families. So we're talking about a number of people. And that demon speaks to one, but one, and very specific. And a known one. That demon speaks to one that is known. Not instead of saying a demon, which would be evil, devil, that kind of thing. That demon, when we talk about that demon, we are talking about something very specific. And by the fact that she is referring to something very specific, it tells us that she has something very specific in mind.
Here we go. That was it.
Yep.
That was it. That was the colored marble that slipped out.
Yep.
That instead of changing the color, we're just looking at for what it is.
Right.
Is it difficult for you, knowing the affidavit, for instance, knowing about the 109,000 deviant images, is it difficult for you to keep that information from entering into the analysis?
I do ask myself the question, am I being fair and, you know, and unbiased? I sometimes will go back through my analysis and say, no, I do know this information, and therefore I can't jump to this conclusion. I can't, you know, this is not a fair and unbiased, assumption or conclusion on my part. So I will try to ignore what is out there in terms of information. And in this case, actually, that has happened quite a bit because you've been in on it since, January of 2011, and I was involved in other things last year, so I was in and out of it, so I haven't heard all that you have heard, and I have found that that has actually been helpful in doing some of the analysis, this later analysis, because I don't know all the details, and that allows me then to make an analysis that is totally unbiased, unjudgmental, and as it should be.
I think that's a safety valve that can be used where even an awareness of possible bias is a help against the bias.
Oh, yes. Yes.
We talked about the Evanone Sapir's 40% rule or 40% theory that over the years has caused me to have so many aha moments where I just am in awe and think, where did he get this? The 40% theory is that if an analyst works through a statement, and we'll consider it maybe a lengthy statement or a very rich and full statement, not something terribly short, and in completing the analysis, the analyst went into the statement. The analyst entered into the verbalized reality, went into the case pretty deeply. So there's going to be an emotional impact, and there's going to be an intellectual impact. There's going to be exhaustion. There's going to be emotions going up, emotions going down. And what he said was if you put away the statement and return to it at a later date where the mind and heart are cold towards it, the same statement will yield up to 40% more information than what you had done, say, a year ago. And I found that to be the case, and eventually, as I worked through more and more statements, I learned why it was the case, is because as I'm going along, and let's say the word demon is what really grabbed me, and I went into a long trail of why someone might call someone a demon, what are the attributes of a demon, has the person used the word demon in their personal, internal, subjective dictionary before, and really gone into it, my mind and emotions are impacted by that. And by the fact that the remains were just found and that the mother is still provocatively making statements and that the lawyer lied about speaking to Curtis Lloyd. And on it goes. There are a lot of emotions involved and invested there. To step away and then go back into a statement, I often find words that I passed over that did not speak to me the way they do now with that kind of a cold, fresh look to it. So I have found it to be amazingly true. Kind of an example of that, I know I don't want to go too far off topic, was you had found words in a statement involving this case that we can't talk about, but I can use the words, where someone said, a house in which I lived at the time.
Mm, yes.
And I was taken back by your work on the word in which. Because there are pretty simple other ways to say that, house where I lived.
Yeah, actually there was no in. It was, that was the thing. There was, no, it wasn't the house.
Which I was living instead of where I was living.
Yes, which I was living. That was the phrase instead of where I was living, yes.
Yeah, and you did a kind of an exploration that really talked about a mindset that surrounds that. Kind of even like a lifestyle. And that type of of depth really does take time, and it can be exhausting. So I think that stepping back and having fresh eyes is really quite helpful in these type of cases, especially where there is so many emotions involved and the fact that an innocent child is at stake. That fair to say that the 40% rule kind of applies there?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yes, I should say. And by the way, I have a theory on absolutely, which I'll go into at some point, but we don't have time tonight. because I do study language. When I hear myself using language, such as the word absolutely, I know that I am saying yes, and I'm saying yes, but yes emphatically, for a certain reason. And so absolutely doesn't always mean, for me, isn't always a bad or not a reliable affirmation. Anyway, as you said, yes, the 40% rule is very much so true with me. And I do have to go back over and over and over statements. And I do work slowly. The problem that I have when I read a statement, if I read a statement all in its entirety, it all comes at me at once and becomes a jumble. And it's like having, you know, quick flashes of stuff flying at your face. I can't process it that fast. So that's why I need to slow down and be very careful and move very. I plod when I go through a statement. I plod through it. And sometimes I get mired down in it, and then I have to get up and walk away from it. And that's why some of the statements, you know, I sit down and I've worked on them, and then you don't hear from me for a while on them because I've had to walk away because I'm so deeply mired, perhaps even in just one word.
Wow.
And it's exhausting.
It is. I know that we're pressed for time. I do want to let listeners know that the threatening note that was left on the windshield of Curtis Lloyd is being investigated by the FBI. So local investigators have turned it over, and they do have some videotapes. It's very grainy of the parking lot, so that it's very possible they may find the person who wrote that. Karen, we've talked about whether it's a male or female and how difficult it is to tell at times, especially if there were two people involved, one coach and the other. But I think we both concluded that the intent of the note was more mischievous than it was an actual threat of violence. Do you want to speak to that?
Yes. Yeah, I think that when I read this, and it starts out, yes, hey, Mr. Lloyd, and then dead man, hey, dead man. Dead man is a term that you use when you have already made the decision that that person is dead. They've done something, and they're going to die for it. That's how
dead man
is used.
You're
a dead man kind of thing. So it showed me at the beginning, okay, maybe that's, this could be a little serious. But by the end of the statement, at the end of the note, it says, if you go on TV again and say anything bad about Sean Boy, you're going to die too. Well, now the intent has changed because now the writer, the subject, is giving back the control to Mr. Lloyd, that all he has to do is just stay off of TV and not say anything bad about Sean Boy, and he's not going to die. So that told me right there that there was a conflict with the person, that, yeah, they were starting out all hot and they were really going to make Mr. Lloyd nervous and threaten him. But by the end of it, the threat had sort of petered out a little bit. So that's why I thought, you know what, this is more to a mischievous note. And also, too, it could be, I think, maybe a personal, there's maybe a personal vendetta against Mr. Lloyd for some reason or another. And that, you know, as I said in my analysis I sent you, Peter, I do feel that the person who wrote this knows Mr. Lloyd and knew him before Haley's bones, before he discovered Haley's bones.
Could this be a person that was jealous that he was on television?
Yes, yes. And that's one of the things I mentioned. I think that the remark, "You think you are so smart." And now, here's where we have to take it word by word by word. And we've all heard this phrase, "You think you're so smart." And what I did is to take it apart and to think about it very carefully. And what does that actually mean? And first of all, "You think you're so smart." That's an opinion. That's this person's opinion. The person is not stating a fact. They're stating their opinion. But in order to form an opinion about someone, usually you have to have some type of knowledge or familiarity or experience with that person. You don't generally have an opinion of someone that you don't know or that you don't have any experience with, you know, like a stranger. So that's why I think that the subject had enough contact or enough knowledge, enough experience with Mr. Lloyd to be able to form this opinion. And the questions that I had put forth to say that Mr. Lloyd should be asked the following questions, did Mr. Lloyd receive a promotion, a bonus, a recognition for something that another felt should have gone to him or her? Does Mr. Lloyd supervise others? And being as what he does, as you know, that he works in a prison, this could also extend to prisoners. If it's not just people who work for him, but it could be people who are present in his place of employment, and how does a prisoner get a note out onto somebody's car? Well, they have visitors. It's possible that someone wrote the note for the prisoner. So we have to keep our minds open as to the possibility that this may even not be directly related at all to Haley Dunn's case.
Could it be someone, or even for Curtis to be considering these things, someone that he's recently corrected, including an inmate possibly, someone
yes.
that he has said, "No, you're wrong, it's this way," causing the person to say, "You think you're so smart."
Exactly, because smart, he had other words, the subject had other words to choose from. They could have said, "You think you're so good, you think you're so cool, you think you're so hot, because you did this." Instead, the subject chose the word smart, which speaks to intelligence. And when you think about it, in using that phrase, "You think you're so smart," generally the person who uses that phrase feels somehow inferior to the person that they're saying it to. And they're saying it to try to knock them down a peg or two, or challenge their smartness.
Like someone else smarted them in something, or appeared to be more intelligent?
Right. The person actually feels inferior to Mr. Lloyd. And by saying, "You think you're so smart," is hoping to, number one, challenge Mr. Lloyd, challenge his smartness, and in the process, try to denigrate or bring down his opinion of himself, because it's really the subject's opinion of what Mr. Lloyd's opinion is of himself. "You think you're so smart." That's what he's commenting on.
Hmm.
And
the anonymous work is difficult, huh?
Pardon?
The anonymous work is difficult.
Yeah. Yep. It is.
Hey, Peter and Karen.
Yeah,
I got a couple of questions, and I'm not sure if you can answer them at this point, but could this note be co-written by Andrea and Sean? And if you can't comment on that, that's okay. It's just something that one of our listeners put out there.
Well, I think I can touch a little bit on it, that I don't have very much experience working in anonymous letters, a little bit, but not much. And Karen, I'm finding what you sent me and what you're disclosing to the audience to really be something that needs to be considered, especially the fact that there may be that familiarity of someone in some form of competition with Curtis. It makes a lot of sense to me. So,
I think
this is probably.
Yeah, and especially someone by calling him Mr. Lloyd. He or she had a whole bunch of other ways of putting it. Hey, Lloyd. Hey, Curtis. You know, hey, dead man. You know,
Hey, dead man.
Yeah, hey, dead man. And as you pointed out in your analysis, Peter, that there was no need to actually identify Mr. Curtis or Mr. Lloyd because it was sitting on his car.
Yeah.
But the fact that "Hey, Mr. Lloyd" was the first thing that he wrote, or I have to say he and she. I mean, when I say he, imagine I'm saying he and she. But it's that Mr. Lloyd is how he addresses Curtis Lloyd.
Yeah.
Addresses him, and that puts the Mr. Lloyd, or puts the subject in a position that he has to, perhaps it's maybe a little formal, and that he has to show respect to Mr. Lloyd.
Right. That brings me to the next question we have from Katie, 8. Did he ever request an employee or prisoner to call him Mr. Lloyd? I mean, it kind of goes hand in hand with what you're saying is, you know, this could be a disgruntled inmate.
Question.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. All things are possible.
Yeah.
And statement analysis is to open the doors. And it is for the investigators to step in, take a look around, and choose what doors they're going to walk through and what doors they're going to close.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But all we can do is open the doors.
Yep, that's all we can do. Any thoughts about 2 arrests being made? And I don't know if you can touch on this, Peter and Karen. Karen, I don't know. But we do have a question about, will there be 2 arrests?
Well, obviously we don't know, but my guess is yes, there will be 2 arrests. What I don't know is, in my own working through of what happened, I don't know if there was any collusion with a third party after the fact. But 2 arrests, yes.
Okay. Well, we're just about out of time. We've got a little under 2 minutes here, so I think we should wrap it up. Thank you, everybody, for coming. Gosh, thank you, Karen, as always.
Oh, you're very welcome. You're very
welcome. It's so nice to have you here. And Peter, you the man. Thanks to our public relations team at ImaginePublicity.com. Our next show will be next Tuesday. Tune in as we continue to analyze cases that wreak havoc on families looking for answers and seeking justice, and discuss crime-related topics with the experts. To hear a rebroadcast of tonight's show, go to www.crimewire.blogspot.com. Turn on your volume at your computer, and this show will automatically play. Until next time, God bless and stay safe. And thank you, all of our listeners, for joining us tonight. You bring us a wealth of knowledge and information. And Peter, always thank you. And Karen, thank you and God bless.
Thank you.
Good night.
Good night.